All right, Steve Dove is the Minister of Algorithms for Wheatstone, a major U.S. broadcast audio manufacturer and proprietor of WheatNet. Using everything from valves to DSP, Dove has for over 40 years designed audio equipment for radio and TV broadcast, for film, recording, and for live sound. And he has a long list of innovative design techniques, award-winning products, and patents to his credit. He has recently been active in the definition of relevant standards for audio transport via digital, including the recently ratified AES 67. Please welcome Steve Dove.
Hey, good morning. Thank you, Jason. Thank you to the Wisconsin Broadcasters Clinic for the invitation. Greatly appreciated. And I got to stay in a hotel on Fourier Drive. How cool is that? It's my hero. Ah, talking of heroes, who's the guy? I know you're here. Who's the guy with the immense ham screwdriver on the back of their wagon? Magnificent. Thank you. Okay, we're going on a bit of a magical mystery tour here. That is, I'm going to give a story arc of how we got to where we are in networking, audio over IP, and the briefest of drive-bys on the history of networking. Poke under the rock at darker and more obscure, less sexy and less obvious parts that make AOP work and become a system. Now, bear in mind, I'm a design engineer, I'm not a salesman, so things are a bit warped from my perspective. Have to remember that what's on the marketplace today, I was working on years ago, and what's in my mind currently, and some snippets of what you'll see today, you didn't see them. You know, they're not ready for prime time, they're certainly not ready for disclosure, but they're real. AOIP, an undiscovered country. And the audio is the easy bit. There's an awful lot thundering around in a true audio network that isn't actually audio. And that's what we're going to dive into and explore in a bit more detail later on. In fact, there's going to be some blue sky and some 30,000 foot overview, and there's going to be some real nitty gritty too. Huh. That's disparate, not desperate. Yeah. This is something we'll get to as well, which is, okay, what do you do if you've got two different networks, one of ours and one of theirs, and you want to try to get them to talk to each other? The issues with nailing different networks together. Anyway, networking is messy and complicated, which is why a lot of you have gigs. It's conceptually very simple, but it went downhill really quickly. I mean, even just 25 years ago, the future was not obvious. It certainly wasn't obvious that Ethernet would end up ruling the world. So if any of you there are of nervous disposition or at all squeamish, I would turn away for the next few seconds. It's okay, it's safe now. You think it couldn't be worse? Twin axe, anybody? Remember those marks on the coax? That's where you had to put the T-junctions, otherwise you destroyed the SWR on the network and it stopped working. Oh, joy. And it wasn't blue wire back then, it was black. RG58, actually, with BNCs on the end. And you got a blistering 2 megahertz. Okay, shall we put audio down that? Jolly good. Anyway, it really got interesting when we were starting to make digital consoles. Okay, how do we move bunches of audio around? We're going to need to make this, to take advantage of digital audio. In fact, to make it work at all, we've got to move large amounts of audio. So we looked at IP, which at that time was just about breaking into 100 megs as being common currency down at Staples. We poked at 100 megs, it poked back. It was basically unpleasant. There wasn't enough room, it was too fussy, too much overhead, just too much and too little. It really wasn't a very good place to go, so we didn't. Now, let me explain something about our industry, the audio industry in particular. There's this little thing out there called Goliath industry, massive, huge. The internet, you know, the largest man-made structure known on Earth ever in history. Fantastic. Huge endeavor. And then we have the audio industry, which is the little dot just over there, which is basically, you know, we're a pimple on a pimple on the backside of nothing at all. And we're the only industry which does this. We reinvent networking. We've not just done it once, we've done it again and again. But it was not just us, not just Wheatstone. At the time of the 100 meg introduction, there were loads of different companies all doing more or less essentially the same thing. And the conclusion we came down to was this. The cable was great and cheap. The connectors were the connectors. The isolation transformers were superb. The PHY chips were great and cheap. But IP itself was a pain in the anterior. We really didn't want to go there. So we used all the existing great, cheap componentry and made TDM systems. What's TDM? Time Division Multiplex. And for all the different variants we made, it's essentially you get a whole bunch of audio packets, serialize them, and then send them down the pipe at an exact predetermined time interval. So you've got utter determination over the system. The original WheatNet was like this, lots of others. 64 bits of audio down a pipe, each direction, ace. CobraNet was probably the most popular. And I think that was mostly because they had a drop-in and drop-out format. You could look at the pipe as it was coming to you, extract 8 channels from it, mess with them, and then stick them back in the pipe. It's rather clever. Typically, the network is arranged as star distribution. You had a giant central hub or a central router, and everything fed into it. Well, that's good. And what it meant was the bridge, which was Wheatstone's version of exactly this kind of thing, had vanishingly low latency. Let me put this into context. AOIP nowadays, WheatNet is about a millisecond per leg from here to here, and then from the switch another millisecond to wherever it's going. A TDM system, the bridge system, is measured in samples. That's lumps of 20 microseconds. Typically, a latency on a leg on a TDM system is about 60 or 80 microseconds. Sorry. Timekeeping problems? Nope. Synchronization? Why? It's deterministic. Discovery? Discovery. Basically meant you picked up a bit of wire and tugged on it and see where it went. Actually, there's a lot to love about TDM systems. And if you're thinking about doing a system, at least look at it, because although it means you've got to design the thing completely from the outset, and if you're building a big radio station or a TV station and you're not designing things from the outset, you're a blithering idiot anyway. Anyway, all these TDM systems we built, all the bridge systems were out there. We learned an awful lot. Like, it's not just the audio. That's the easy part. We learned about remoting things. We got to be real good buddies with all the automation systems. Press button here. Something happens there. Light goes on over there. Lift a fader. Light goes on. Speakers mute. Nothing extraordinary. But if you no longer have bits of wire connected together to do all that, it has to go through the network. So lots of integration of the control and command. And it's not obvious at the outset, certainly wasn't to us, the complexity involved in doing all this. And that's a step many people miss. They're sort of blinkered by the shiny, blinky audio and miss the fact that there is all this complexity, all this wiring to be dealt with as well. Now, things started getting really interesting when IP was glimmering on the horizon at a gigahertz. That made us stop and scratch and go, well, okay. I mean, we've got probably enough bandwidth in our system using TDM at 100 megs, but a gigahertz at IP, we can allow for all the slop and all the overhead and the packets being trodden on and everything else and get similar or better performance. Okay, this is starting to look right. The stars are in alignment. And also, at this point, every computer had an IP stack, which made things slicker and easier. But probably the biggest factor was that the radio industry was starting to get more of an IT skill set than an analog engineering skill set. And IT people love IP. They'd much rather have an IP system. So 1 gig IP it was. Now, IP recovers nicely on collisions, but the trade-off for that, of course, is it demands excess latency and buffers. The safer you want the system to be, the more latency you have to build in. Ideally, you want a clean pipe that's so capacious you never get collisions. And for moderate-sized systems, 1 gigahertz actually affords you that. So there's a kind of idiot paradox here. You go to gigahertz IP so that you never have to use the main virtue of IP, which is the collision detection. Okay. So IP is more flexible. The boxes are more flexible. You can pick them up, take them anywhere, reroute them with the lovely shiny blue wire. It's more flexible, and there's less blithering involved. But here's the important point again. Although the transport mechanism has changed, we're now over IP rather than dedicated wires, the functionality hasn't changed. We still have to get all those commands and bits of wire through the pipe. So there's a three-legged stool on which audio sits. Control, clocking, and discovery. And we're looking definitely closer at all of those. Now, although this talk is about IP networks in general, I'll be referring a lot to Wheatnet IP since I know it best. And this, of course, has absolutely nothing to do with a relentless quest for world domination. Well, much. Yep, without these, there isn't an audio network, and the biggest by far is command, configuration, and control. Now, you've probably all seen the XY controllers for IP routing. Inputs on X, outputs on Y, and you click on the little crosshairs between them and it makes the audio connection. But again, what's not obvious are the attributes which go along with each cross point. This is the wiring between the source and the destination. Again, so many people don't get this. It's so easy to dismiss the unsexy wires and switches and blinkies, but it's the difference between nothing and a system. We have what's called LIOs, logic input outputs, and lots of them. On each of our boxes, wherever they are, whatever they are, we have oceans of these things. They're opto-isolated, So you can make them common ground or common supply so they can switch or drive anything in any polarity and remove yourself from ground loops if that's the case. The associations are the same as the audio on the XY controller for the sources and destinations. Say you've got a CD player and it's going to a console input. The XY controller, the system knows that the CD has this audio output, it needs this closure to make it go, it's returning this light to say the disc is ready, and this light to say it's playing, and the console knows what to do with these. The neat part is that if you then decide you're going to reroute that CD player to another input on another console, to another input on the same console, or onto a different console altogether, those attributes follow with no other intervention whatsoever. Click, click, that channel console now knows that there's a CD player on the end of it, knows how to control it, and knows how to interpret the flags that are coming back from it. Here's a really simple example. I've just outlined it, actually. The top line is the audio routing, and the other three are the flags. The machine stop and start going from the console to the CD player, and coming back from the CD player are two flags, being a ready and an I'm playing. Again, once the CD is connected, the system remembers its audio requirement connectivity and also the LIO attributes. Click, rewire, follow that in analog, Batman, see how long that takes you. Now, this next slide is going to be a little bit horrific, and I have no intention of going through it in detail, only to illustrate how much is involved in emulating bits of wire in digital through a network. The top line is the audio. The system is setting up the audio output from the player into the console. The rest of it is just the messaging going to and fro, 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 to make the thing work. No wires, all done in virtually over the wire, over the network. Again, LIOs, lots and lots of them. Now, if you stick Wireshark on our network or anybody else's network, you'll see an insane amount of this stuff going on in even just a modest console system. Now, consider other sources which are less simple, a remote mic amp. You've got input gain, phantom on off, polarity reverse. They are all attributes and controls which follow through to the console. Again, you move that mic amp across to another console input, all those attributes follow, and all the control works backwards too. And a more extended mic amp, which has got, say, EQ and dynamics in, all the parameters of the EQ and dynamics and all the metering from it go backwards and forwards between the mic amp and the console. And again, if you reassign or you split that mic across multiple consoles, all those parameters follow too, automatically. Other systems, automation systems, playout systems. It's essentially just faders and switches, but again, they all follow. Hybrid control, satellite receivers, all those zillions of unsexy wires gone. What's that word again? System. And it all goes down the network. Ever wondered what's in a digital console? Four blue boxes on a PowerPoint, that's what. It's a bit of a detour, but it's kind of relevant. The top layer is the fingers to digits bit. Press a button on the control surface, there's a little micro in there, says, oh, button's been pressed, and it debounces it, cleans it up, and decides whether it's a momentary or a latching, whatever. Looks at the controls. They're completely unstopped rotary controls, but it then decides, okay, I'm at one end, I'm sending a code of 0. I'm at the other end, I'm sending a code of 255. So that's transferring fingers into digits, and they go down the first big blue arrow to the next processor, which is called the host, console surface host, which is a bit of a bigger computer. Generally, it's a larger micro, and it's capable of looking at a network. This takes the raw parameter, the raw data coming off the smaller micros, and it turns them into human understandable parameter values in context. So if this button happens in context to be high pass filter in, it then knows to send to create a parameter which says high pass filter in. If you turn this control and it happens to be mapped to low frequency boost and cut on an EQ, minus 15, plus 15. So for every virtual control on the console, parameters are generated and mapped in that processor. Those are then passed down to the main processing host, which may or may not be in the same box. We'll get to that in a minute. And that turns these lovely, readable, human understandable parameters, like dB, hertz, percent, into the ghastly coefficients that DSPs need to work properly, and passes those indecipherable numbers down actually into the audio DSP processing, which is either in DSP or in field programmable gate arrays, whatever. It doesn't really matter. Now, the interesting part there are the three arrows. If you have a control surface and a mix engine, and that's the usual way it goes nowadays, where do you make the decision? Which blue arrow do you take the information through from surface to engine? Now, on medium-sized consoles, it's typically the middle one. You get parameters and send the parameters over the network, and the two bottom processors are remote from the top two processors. But some we've taken the top arrow, so you're actually just sending raw data down. And in some mixers, oddly enough, big ones, we send coefficients. It really doesn't matter, because for the most part, we aren't terribly interested in anybody else in the real world knowing what those parameters are, or those values, or the DSP coefficients. It's just to us. They just happen to be sent down the line. Metering. That's another thing everybody forgets about. Okay, you've got all this lovely glitzy audio, and you've got all these buttons and knobs and things, but you forget about how to get the metering back, and trust me, the first digital console I ever built, we forgot about it, and we had to put in another network just to bring the metering back. There are two ways of doing it. There's internal, within the structure of a digital console here. The big processor at the bottom for the audio DSPs, they generate bar graph metering because it's easy to determine what they are and what they look like and how they feel. And they also have access to things like dynamics gain reduction, which is always interesting and useful to meter. And they get passed back up the pipe through the arrows in the reverse direction until they bubble up and they appear as blinkies on the control surface driven by the little micros at the top. So that's internal metering. The other is what I really call peripheral metering. And that means that everything on the network, all the audio inputs and all the audio outputs of anything on the network are accessible to anybody else on the network. So if it's really important for you to measure look at the metering of some other console or the station output. That is quite useful. It's very easy to go out and grab them and bring them back. To have an aggregating device with a whacking great big screen on them so that you can look at many things at once and different kinds of varieties of metering, that can be quite powerful. Now, imagine this sitting in your station's foyer. It's the world's most extravagant on-air light. All the things around the outside are little bar graphs, which are inputs and outputs of various studios, playout systems, and so on and so forth. There are plenty of stereos there, a few monos. And the two big things in the middle are FFTs of the 192 kilohertz, 192K FFTs of the multiplex signal being sent to the transmitter, and I believe the one below it is what's being received off the transmitter. So it's really obvious if something gets broken. Bliss. Well, what's the point of all this? The system is an emulation of a whole bunch of wires. More importantly, it's the affordance of features hitherto impossible. Imagine doing that in an analog complex. Yeah, it's that system thing again. Yeah, as a bit of an aside, WeNet IP, unlike all the other networks out there, doesn't require a big fat lump of intelligence sitting on the network as master. Yes, you need a PC to initialize the system, configure, reconfigure, do all the little cross-point dobbies, but that's basically a once and done, or going in every now and again as the system as the station reconfigures. But once you've done that, you fold the computer up and you take it home. The system does not have a single point of failure. Each of the boxes on the network has the entire knowledge of the network. The system intelligently selects masters from within itself. Every unit on WeNet IP, from the grandest control surface down to the most lowly headphone amp, is capable of being a system master, and often are. Well, so much for command. Now we're talking about clocks. Clock syncing is a bit necessary. You have to make absolutely sure that all the audio inputs, all the A to D converters, all the sample rate converters coming in, and all the output D to A converters going out of the system are all being clocked simultaneously. And we'll have a quick moment of silence to consider the alternative, and that was long enough. Now, all our blades, all our units have pretty accurate clocks in them. But syncing needs a master source. You can't have multiple clocks going on at the same time, or it turns into a disaster really quickly. So the system needs to figure out, okay, you are clock master. And this is done with a rather posh title of clock master arbitration. And it looks at a few criteria. First one is being the clock quality attribute, which varies from normal to superior, gospel, external, or inflexible. So if you've got a gospel clock, which could be GPS referenced or rubidium or something, okay, it'll take that over anything with ordinary clocks. But if you've got something coming from outside that you can't control the clocking from and you have to link to it, then we'll do that. Right now, Sorry, right now we do that with AES-67. If we get an AES-67 external source coming into us, okay, you're master. Reason for that is that AES-67 uses typically a good clock, either rubidium or GPS referenced. But if all's normal, you know, a normal everyday IP system with nothing special going on, the system sort of shrugs and picks one. Normally it's based on centrality, which is a unit which is electrically in the center or as close to the center of the system as you can get, so that the difference in path length between it and its nearest neighbor and it and the most distant unit on the network is least. It doesn't mean that the overall distance is least, but the delta between the shortest and the longest is smallest. That's called centrality. And that's usually the criterion on which the clockmaster is selected. Do a general rundown on synchronization methods. And the most basic is metronome. We send a click, clonk, around the network, clonk, on a regular basis, clonk, that all the other things on the network go, okay, all right, okay, and it refers itself to the regularity of the metronome. It's usually sent as a discrete multicast in the naive hope that it won't get trodden on by any other packets. Good luck with that. At a regular interval of, say, 10 milliseconds, which translates, of course, into about 100 hertz. And each of the receivers in each of the units looks at this 100 hertz coming in and phase lock loops its internal reference, say 24576, down to the 100 hertz. There's a window of sanity, so that if a packet does get trodden on, if a metronome does get lost, it's discarded and it isn't counted in. So the anomalies are discarded. But what all this means is that a basic metronome system needs a really slow time constant to smooth over all the glitches and the packets that got dropped and variations in sending time because the switcher got busy that moment and so on and so forth. Very slow to set up, very slow to adjust. It can take minutes for a simple metronome system to settle down, where all the units throughout a system are now running at about the right sample rate. So ideally, we need something which can quickly adjust from cold and then hangs tight and emulates a nice slow time constant when it's locked up. So we notch everything up a layer of indirection to what's called numerical comparison. It's quicker and more robust. The way it works is there's a cyclical counter in each of the units. Each of the units has a counter which goes from 0 to 65 million or something and then starts again. Just keeps going round and round so that at each sample, each metronome period, it's a unique number. Master sends out its metronome pulse with its cyclical counter, and the receiver goes, okay, well, that was interesting, so that's your number. And it looks at its own cyclical counter and goes, okay, this is my cyclical number here, and it makes a note of the difference between them, because they're not going to be the same. Next metronome pulse comes along, it does the same thing. Okay, there's your counter, here's my counter, and if there's a miracle, they're the same. That means that the cyclical counter on the host and the cyclical counter on the receiver are in sync. The sample rates are exactly the same. But what if there's a difference? What if there's a difference in the difference? Sorry. What that means is you've got a numerical difference, an actual number you can use, which tells you how far adrift the receive clock is in relation to the master over the metronome period. So you do this over a few metronome periods and you get an idea of, okay, so I'm running this much slower. The nicest part is, you know it's this much slower, not, oh, I'm slower, I'd better nudge the integrator a bit. It's, I'm this much slower. So you can throw this number instantly at the numerically controlled oscillator, and bang, you're almost exactly right, just on that difference data. And then, of course, from that point on, it continues to check the cyclical counters. And if there's a slight difference, it doesn't have that much more to move. Take a step back. What this means is that within very few metronome periods, the clocks are banged to be in sync, and then you've got a very slow time constant to keep them in track. It's a much nicer system. Now, AES67 uses IEEE 1588 clocking. There, I've used two acronyms and two alphanumeric names in the same sentence, and most of you are still awake. I'm impressed. AES67 goes a step further, actually a couple of steps further. Personally, I think they've gone over the top, but never mind. Basing their cyclical counters on real-time clock data. So theoretically, every single unit on the system knows exactly what time of day it is, down to the nanosecond. Now, how useful this is in practical terms is open to question, but I can see it in, say, a big rock and roll system where you have distributed speakers all over the place, and you know that at a particular time of day, with particular humidity and particular temperature, the acoustic latency is so long, so you need to adjust delays to be, and okay, knowing the time of day, knowing time precisely, gives you an advantage there. But in keeping clocks straight in a radio or TV environment is not particularly useful. Anyway, the real-time clock origins typically come from nice clocks, as I said earlier. You know, they could be rubidium, GBS, Big Ben, Big Bang, whatever. The syncing aside, all boxes tell exactly the same time. Now, this technique owes a lot to humble old NTP, Network Time Protocol, which every time you've clicked Dimension 4 on your PC, that's what you're using. And I think the reason they're doing it is because it is so well known, and it is reasonably easy to implement. There are similar notions in AES67 of strata in NTP, which is layers of different accuracy away from the gospel clock, and the IEEE master boundary clocks, and so on and so forth. There are direct parallels between the two systems. Syncing real-time clocks takes another step or two over the simple, okay, you're in time now, aren't you, kind of thing. You've got two unknowns. First of all, you've got the slave clock inaccuracy. He's telling one time, he's telling another. But then you've also got the propagation delay between the two, between the master and the slave. Unless you take into account that propagation delay, the receiver cannot accurately reflect what the master is sending. So you have to take that into account. Fortunately, this is fairly easily solved. There are a couple of assumptions, though. The first being that the path is symmetrical. It takes the same amount of time for data to leave the master and arrive at the slave as from the slave to the master. Symmetry. The other assumption is that the packets aren't being trodden on. Again, there's windowing so that there's general common sense backyarding. Make sure none of that's happening. As the system's being synchronized, there are loads and loads of timing packets being sent from the master to the slave. So the slave has already got an accurate idea of the latency on the network. The slave sends a delay request to the master. Master responds with a delay response, which includes its timestamp. Now, given its own and the master's timestamps, the slave can derive the latency and therefore its own offset, so it can correct for both. So it's actually reasonably straightforward and easy to get accurate timing matched across the network. Discovery. Now, anybody who's been in IP for a while has obviously come across the discovery methods used in normal processing, normal IT work, which is basically a newly attached unit goes, "Mummy, Mummy," and the DNS server goes, "Yes, who are you?" 192.168.0.147, sir. Okay, that's discovery. Just banging stuff in and out and everybody finds everything else. But that's just the beginning. Okay, you know that something is out there, but what is it? What does it do? What does it need to see? We have what's called a route master. Yes, big red London bus, double decker, ding ding, hold very tight, please. It's funny where these names come from. The route master is the one unit on the system. Remember, we don't have a host PC sitting there, which is in charge of making sure all the other units get the information that they need to. Our discovery uses a discrete multicast address. Again, it's a notionally separate path, and in the naive hope it's not going to get trodden on, but it's mixed in with all the other packets. Any box in the system can be master. There's no real preference. Once a master, the master tends to stay master, but some reconfigurations could change it. You know, the way ours works, and it's the same as and different to everybody else's, is a bit like this. A box wakes up from cold. It's just been plugged in, stretches its arms and goes, "I am master." It is good to be king. But then a millisecond later, another box shows up and goes, "I am master." And then the mud wrestling begins. Again, the posh word is arbitration. It's a voting system based on worthiness of different factors. Most significantly, number one, uptime. If you have a box which previously has been on the air for 1 year, 7 months, and 32 days, that takes preference over something which was turned on last week. Software version. Units which have the most recent software in tend to take precedence. That weights quite heavily. Seniority. I was master last time. Another biggie. The size of the most recent connectivity. The bigger wins. If you've got a unit which is in the center of the things and it's throwing packets out left and right and it's talking to this and connecting to that and everything else, that tends to take precedence because it's obviously more central, key to the system, and everything else can definitely see it all the time than the headphone amp in Studio 7. There are other criteria as well, but they're the main ones. So the routine goes. It's always one unit against another. "I am master." "No, you're not." Again and again and again. If you've got 60 or 100 units out there, it's real fun to watch this on Wireshark. So you get further through the process. You get master versus a newbie who might become the master. Anyway, the ultimate victor does a roll call at the end of all this. So it talks to each unit in turn through the system, so that ultimately each unit in the system, because they're listening to the network, knows the control knowledge of each and every other unit in the system. Each is containing the DNA of the system. So we've done this. If only one original box survives out of an entire system and all the others are replaced, it becomes the master and it can reestablish the entire network from cold, just from the knowledge within that box. Background, don't need to do anything special. The whole thing springs phoenix-like back into life. Other considerations, if the big central switch goes down, all the other boxes sitting out there on all smaller switches, distribution switches, they can still hear each other, if not the rest of the network. So they go through an I am master arbitration thing within their own little networks. When the big switch comes back, these mini masters duke it out between themselves to see which one comes back as master. At the most normal circumstance, if just one box in the system has to be replaced, you know, a human takes it out of the rack, puts another one in, dials up its number, which is usually just the last quartet of the IP address. It wakes up going, I am master. No, you're not. You've only got an on time of 15 milliseconds. But I know who you are. Cop this. Seconds without doing anything else from putting a new box in the rack. Seconds, and it knows exactly who it was, who it is, and what it should be doing from this point on. Now, this goes interesting places. The constant, continual, and pervasive knowledge of the system leads to strong redundancy. Redundancy control and recovery, as we've just seen. The system self-knowledge leads to interesting places. At the very least, a fault can be reported to Daddy, that's you. Send you an email, flash a light, do whatever it takes, but you'll know all about it. Now, depending on the depth of redundancy invested in at the outset, i.e. the more network you buy and the more redundancy you buy, the system can root around faulty branches, faulty units, and even at the most extreme, fail over to an entirely redundant other system. Self-healing. Self-knowledge, self-healing, and we're working on the self-aware thing. As long as the Russians don't, as long as it doesn't figure out there's a Russian wheat net, we're okay. Who got that reference? You've been such good sports, here's a home video. Traversing the Pyrenees on yaks. No. It'll be fairly self-evident what it is. This is a WheatNet system being booted up from cold. It's a huge system.
Okay, rebuilt.
Hang up.
No.
It's all gone quiet. System's been killed, and the whole thing is coming back up slowly. I love the way all the meters freeze. That's always got me. I've always loved the fact that you can kill the control on a DSP and it still plays music. That's still magic to me. The tension in that room, right, it was palpable. I made the comment that we should all have worn white lab coats with pocket protectors and slide rules, but I got ushered out. You know, they weren't terribly interested in that. You see, it's not taking that long, considering the size of the system. I believe this was Clear Channel Seattle, which we built intact in the factory before it got sent to Seattle. meter's blinking, system's reconfiguring, it's coming back up, round about now. Back in black indeed. Thank you very much to Mr. Johnson of Akadaka for the music. Thank you very much to Mr. Johnson of Wheatstone for the video. Yeah, well, that's fun. It sort of illustrates what lies beneath the jacket of a network. But consider that, round about a minute, an entire city's radio infrastructure is back on the air. This makes Perfect Hairs very happy. So command, clock synchronization, discovery. What's missing? Damn. Okay, you're all professionals. I know I really don't need to say this, but a media IP system shouldn't try to share any other function like the enterprise network in a station or anything like that. You know, as network operators, we're very good at keeping the audio in control and discovery, clock packets out from each under the feet by scheduling them, giving them different priorities, so on and so forth. But chucking other random and weighty stuff on the network is really just asking for it. So, say the upstairs suite is somewhat engrossed in management training videos. And I really don't want to know what the sales guys are looking at. So, enterprise and AOIP, in fact, anything and AOIP are not good bedfellows. Not two networks that you want to interconnect. However, connecting disparate networks. And that's a perfectly good reef knot. It's not common we need to connect disparate systems, say a WheatNet and a LiveWire, a WheatNet and a Ravenna, or WheatNet and whatever. Somebody else might be using at any given time, but it does happen. And as ownership fluctuates, it's probably going to happen more and more. One flavor of IP network needs to interact with another, whether it be in the same building, unusual, but it has happened, or cross-country, cross-city. Historically, this has meant locally, you know, within land striking distance, where you can actually run a piece of blue wire. And the traditional response to that has been AES3. How much audio need to run from one place to the other? Run that many bits of wire. Good, solid performer. Big advantage is that because AES receivers are typically sample rate converted, you don't need to worry about trying to clock synchronize the two systems. But don't forget, if you're trying to use, say, the playout system on the other network, you're going to need to run bits of wires to make it work because there's no networky connection to make it happen so far. Chances are, you know, the playout systems, remotes, tallies, good luck with that. If more than a few audio pairs are needed, the solution, you know, up until a few years ago is MADI. MADI is otherwise known as AES-10. It's a very simple synchronous system, a bit like the TDM systems that I described earlier. And it was historically built from bits used in telco ATM networks, which went out of business and we had to rewrite the whole thing in FPGAs. Originally could manage about 56 discrete audio paths in one direction. You wanted return audio, you need another MADI to bring the audio back. Nowadays we can get 64 down the same pipe, down the same MADI pipe. It used to be used to connect early digital multi-track recorders. I miss the 80s. No, I don't. But the thing about MADI is, don't forget the gaffer tape. What do I mean by that? Well, it's just a technical expression for either using sample rate converters on all the audio paths that you're using. Remember, there's no mechanism of syncing the two systems. So you either need SRCs or word clocking the two systems together. I'm shaking my head on the word clock thing. When word clock fails, it fails spectacularly, and it will fail. So MADI, SRCs. AES-67. What's AES-67? Well, it's recently ratified audio over IP system and sanctified with the AES stamp of approval. The ink was dry about a year ago, and we had an AES-67 interface ready to go. The trouble was nobody else did. It was a very lonely existence. But in a few weeks in Europe, there's going to be what's called a plug fest. What's a plug fest? It's where all the different manufacturers come along with their boxes, with their AES-67 interfaces, and we put them all together in the same room with earnest expressions and test equipment. And there'll be zappy sparks and puffs of smoke and lots of swearing. And then we'll try connecting things together. Anyway, 67 is coming together as we speak. The synchronization is taken care of. That's the one thing that's in AES-67 which is good. The interface with the shiniest clock wins. Yay. Up to 64 audio paths per packet. Yay. These will show up in somebody else's system just as inputs on their normal XY controller. That's easy to take care of. Yay. But the slight snag is that they appear as audio sources 1, 2, 3, 4, 62, 63, 64. Which is why you need... This is so that he can scribble down all the labels and then pass it over to me so I can type them into my system. By the way, 64 isn't a limit. That's just per packet. We can send quite a number of packets, each with 64 bits of audio in. So we haven't yet really discovered what the maximum number of audio paths is. Right now, AES-67 just covers the audio and the clocking. If you've been paying attention, you'll notice that leaves a few things missing, like labeling. However, IP includes all kinds of goodies, not the least of which is SNMP. So, yes, basically, we can automatically email this kind of stuff to each other. Presently, we make this stuff up on the fly and do it on a case-by-case basis. It isn't standardized quite yet, but you know, there isn't anybody we haven't talked to and can't make this work with. Open control architecture is a standard that's being worked on, sponsored by some rather famous names, commercial audio companies. Nobody in broadcasting. This came from commercial audio world. And their proposed system is presently squirming through an AES working group, of which I'm a member. And we're kind of hammering it into shape. It hopes to standardize messaging So that in the, you know, the earlier example, the two systems' label tables automatically get filled. They populate each other. But mostly it's to define the control parameters. You turn this knob on one person's unit, and it does the expected thing on another person's unit. As is the way of standards committees, it's how many ways are there of push the fader up? I can't even, it makes me cry. Anyway, between the lines, OCA suddenly turned up on the doorstep looking to be an AES standard because they got a bit fed up waiting for AVB, which has been real soon now for the last 5 years at least. So I think they're jumping ship to a more vital and more likely path. How useful OCA will be in the rather siloed broadcast environment is yet to be seen. The easy stuff is easy stuff, you know, faders, starts, stops, blinky lights, and so on and so forth, whilst the control of even a simple EQ to both the controller and the controlee's satisfaction is rather fraught, never mind, say, something a touch more complex like an air chain processor. Good luck with that one. If you're remoting things to a different facility, you've then got the problem of available bandwidth, available data rates. Now, a wide area network within a city, if you can, you know, a dedicated link, if both ends are under the control of the same ISP and within the same city and it's the same head end and everything, you stand a good chance of getting a nice chunk of bandwidth which isn't going to go flaky on you. Excellent. Dedicated licensed RF. You know, think present-day STL technology. Just link the complexes together like that. There's always ISM RF, you know, like Ubiquiti's little things, which can either work ridiculously well or barely. The public internet is a scary place for uncompressed audio. Rule of thumb is it takes 10 megs per unprocessed audio, unprocessed stereo pair. So even though theoretically that's only 3 megs of actual data, remember that it's IP. You've got to allow bandwidth for, oh, this got trodden on, I have to repeat it. And remember, there's plenty of other packets clattering around in there too. Couple of novel case studies. BBC, they're playing with a centralized hub for their widely distributed local radio stations. The idea is the local radio station doesn't have a mixer at all. It sends all its sources to the central hub somewhere in the depths of the Midlands. And their control surface controls the virtual mixer in the central hub. All the sources go to the center, the remote control surfaces control the mix in the center, and the outputs are either sent to disk or sent to transmitter. It's very nice if you've got dedicated 10 gigahertz pipes running up and down the country between your various production facilities. We don't. We're kind of stuck with Larry the Cable Guy. Another interesting approach I saw very recently was a sports network. And the approach is using the freedom of putting the control and its processing in separate places, this time to minimize the transport bandwidth. The network has the control surface at Big Time HQ with the production team who like being at Big Time HQ because they don't like to be sent to remote little games. The production team, the mixer itself, and the mic pres and the mics are remote at the game, which can be hundreds of miles away. By doing this, they've they've reduced the cost of sending people to the game. They've got the bandwidth down. Sorry? Okay. Bandwidth. It's all out there. Practicality versus potentiality. What we can get versus what's out there. Now, government and big universities have internet too. My daughter has more bandwidth in her dorm room than we as enterprises would die for. You know the little apps on the computer, you know, gives you bandwidth to the network? Pegged. Anyway, by way of farewell, that's one of our blades, which is in Tampa, I believe, with an uptime of getting on for 4 years. This stuff just works. I humbly thank you for your indulgence.